This is Scott Morey. This is the RE Insight podcast series, sponsored by GPG Advisors. And we're honored today to have Mark Rose, who is the CEO of Avis & Young, which is a great story that we're going to go through. And if I read online correctly in the statistics, I mean, I know your rapid growth we'll talk about since you've been part of that firm. But I believe today you have an excess of 2,400 professionals, 79-plus offices. I think your revenue at the end of last year actually was somewhere just over, you know, half a billion U.S. dollars. And I think it's a great story. Now, having said that, Mark, I know you and I met years ago. You've had this amazing background and trajectory, I think, career-wise. And what I'd like to do is go back, way back, actually, because I know and believe you graduated high school at the age of 16, which is quite early for most people. But I'd love to go back. I believe you grew up in New York, and if you could share kind of where you grew up and talk about high school and talk about sort of initially graduating at 16 and we'll go into college after that, that would be great.
Sure, happy to, Scott. Well, first things first, my upbringing was just incredibly normal, right? Queens, New York, Little Neck to be exact, and the youngest of four sons in a family with a homemaker mother and a woodworking father. And you know, your family instills in you, you know, the values to commit to school, to commit to doing right by people and working really hard. And I was the beneficiary of parents who had that belief system. And also, as the youngest of four boys, you make sure that you probably work a little harder, because you're never heard unless you do. And so it was, you know, in many ways quite traditional and a very happy childhood, you know, growing up at that time. In terms of being in high school, or in Canada, as we say, grades 9 and 10, 11 and 12, that was interesting, because when you're in 10th grade, and my high school started in grade 10, and you're 13 years old, when many other people there, including, you know, obviously the seniors, are 18, that's very different. That was, I would say, difficult. I'd say uncomfortable. I think it teaches you to grow up, probably matured a little earlier in terms of one's thought process, but on the other hand, physically, you're incredibly immature to the rest of the individuals attending school. And very honestly, I mean, I loved graduating and entering university at 16. But if I had a chance to do it all over again, being a 13-year-old in high school, it was pretty difficult. It's very difficult socially. And you know, you just aren't like anybody else. But on the glass half full side, you either adapt or you get crushed. And I think that, you know, it forced a little bit more of the adaptation to make sure that you find your place. You know, at that time. But it was a bit of a challenge.
And when you went, because you went to Queens College, did you move into the dorms or move out of the house, or was it sort of you started in the house and got out, or what happened actually there?
Well, no, it's an interesting story. Because I was only 16, my parents really insisted I stay local. And, you know, the City University of New York, the Queens College campus, you know, was excellent in the delivery of education, especially around accounting and finance, and it was local. And my parents were pretty adamant that I wasn't ready yet to go somewhere. So I started at Queens, started well, stayed there, enjoyed it, became part of the hockey team, which was pretty important to me. Yes, I was 16, and in my freshman year, you know, I was 5'10", 160, but then 1 year later I was 6'2", 230. And, you know, that in and of itself was a big change, but being part of, you know, the ice hockey team, you know, at Queens, being part of, you know, the water polo team there, that it was something that I enjoyed along with the campus, along with what I was being taught. And so there was no reason to look anywhere else. You know, it ultimately led to my getting involved in the political process, and I was one of the leaders of a political party called United People that really from the time, you know, I ran in my sophomore year, I think we went something on the order of 25 or 30 straight years of never giving up a seat in the, you know, in the Senate at our school. So, yeah, we had some great times there.
You played water polo, did you also, or not?
I did. Yeah, I did.
And at the same time, were you doing both at the same time, or water polo come later?
No, I started, but couldn't keep up both sports. Actually, my oldest brother was the head swim coach of St. John's University, and my second oldest brother was, you know, a very good water polo player. I had a chance to play, you know, in different tournaments, and, you know, I started off, you know, you're 16, you're coming into college, you know you're going to play ice hockey. The coach of the water polo team was a friend of my oldest brother's and said, you know, why don't you play? You were kind of born for it. But somewhere around October, it was way too much, you know, to study, to learn to have a social life, trying to play both sports, and I gave up water polo and just concentrated on, you know, on ice hockey, which was really my passion.
Gotcha. And then graduating from Queens College, your degree was in, it was in accounting, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, you know, it's interesting because I went there, the programs that they have for accounting, and they're known for it at Queens College, and started to take some pre-law classes, and my last semester was actually an internship up at the state legislature in Albany. And, you know, although I had the accounting background, which is great for, you know, for any element of business, I really did think until that internship that I would move over to law. And being up in Albany and seeing the behavior of how laws actually get passed, meaning most of them get passed on the last day of session, and the behaviors of certain senators and representatives, and it soured me a little bit, you know, on the law side, and really kept me going or pushed me more towards the accounting side.
And then was your first job at, I know you were at Helmsley Enterprises for a while, was that your first job, or did you do something in between?
No, I actually worked at Eisner & Lubin. I was offered, you know, an opportunity to join Eisner & Lubin. I was offered an opportunity to join Price Waterhouse, and again, just kind of building on a similar thought process, I was still very young, right? You're graduating at just, you know, almost 21. And, you know, you head out there, and I chose the smaller pond to be a little bit of a bigger fish. And sometimes you just get lucky, right? Many other people would have gone the Price Waterhouse route. But Eisner & Lubin had a number of prominent New York real estate firms. Helmsley Enterprises was the largest client, and I had the opportunity to work on some of the Helmsley companies, but I had great fortune with the partner that I was working with, you know, to work on Harry and Leona's personal financial statements and their tax issues. And that was really quite interesting, and then to find out later on what Leona Helmsley did, you know, inside her corporation for, you know, again, life lesson, you know, 101. But, you know, I spent 12 out of 12 months on Helmsley accounts as well as several other clients who were public in real estate and nature. So it was really quite an education for me.
No, it's amazing. Now I'm going to shift gears, and it's related, though, in some ways. Is I believe it was at Helmsley that you met Jim Bozy, if I pronounce his last name correctly, who you have talked about before as being a great mentor early in your career. So I want to talk about that relationship, and of course, one of the questions I talked about before was sort of understanding what mentors you've had in your career and what role they have played. And I know certainly Jim is someone you've mentioned in the past. And I'd love to learn more around how you met him and the dynamics around that, and how over the years, because I know you then went from later on joined him at Pan American Properties. I think he was chairman at the time. And you rapidly sort of grew up in the ranks there, actually, to CEO, and then I think eventually you got sold off. But I'd love to understand that relationship, if you could expand on it.
Well, not sure you have enough time for this, but we're going to try.
Okay.
You know, it's something that, whether it's my children or any of the active mentees, I have today almost 20 active mentees, that I have to impress upon that there's no better education, there's no bigger blessing than to have someone who will take the time to, you know, to be a mentor. Now, Jim, and his last name is Boise, but Jim was the vice chair of Morgan Guarantee, right, so one of the parts of what's now J.P. Morgan. And he had mandatory retirement, I believe it was at 63, and he went over to work with Harry over at Helmsley Enterprises, and I knew him, I would run into him in the halls in the building. But didn't really know if I would ever work with him. I just saw him and, he was a fairly senior, well known exec. This is a guy that when the Hunts tried to corner the silver market in the 70s, Paul Volcker called him to help participate out billions of loans in the morning to help the market stay afloat. And it turns out that when I went over to Pan American, Jim was on the board, and honestly, the first thing that he did was to give me some credibility that here I am, I'm 23, and I was brought over and I'm sitting in the board meetings, really as a controller at that point, having come over to take a quasi-public company fully public. And having joined in August of 1987, we were right in the middle of the process to go public. And our CEO at the time, she took a two-week vacation that extended our offering date past what is now, the crash of 1987. But to be at the board table and to have someone treat you like you're a person, and trust me, there were a few board members that, weren't quite sure of somebody that young being in the room, but Jim was, absolutely incredible in that regard. And then as we started to do a little bit of the work post, failing of the IPO, you couldn't take a company public after the crash in 87, and we went into asset management mode, it was very clear to see that we had $1 billion of real estate across an ocean on behalf of the pensioners of the British coal pension funds. And we were yielding probably 3% at that time off of that value. We needed $50 million of CapEx. So having had the idea and working with Jim to say, to communicate back to the trustees that it didn't make any sense. And oh, by the way, we were seeing trouble. Things were too frothy in the markets in the U.S., and we made the pitch that they didn't belong owning $1 billion of assets over here, not in real estate, not in illiquid assets, because it really didn't match to the pension fund's objectives at that time. And oh, by the way, your own currency, the gilt, was yielding 13 or 14% risk-free, and this was yielding 3. And that created a moment where Jim is my chairman, because at that time, he went as a board member to chairman, and I had moved up to become the CFO at that point, and having written this document that we really should sell the company, that you can imagine the balance of management, including the CEO who hired me, didn't think that was a very good idea. But it was, and we had conviction, and I think that that was the moment really when Jim went all in on saying that, you know, I'm going to invest my time in you. And I believe that, you know, I never had this conversation with him while he was still alive, but, you know, I think he had other mentees, but I just know that he was, you know, instrumental, monumental in my career. Really, first the faith and confidence, and then it was really after that that you begin to see why people who have come before you have forgotten more than you know. There was a situation where we were successful and the trustees did agree to sell, and we were able to sell all of our retail assets and all of our office assets in 1989. And, mm-hmm. you know, the British Coal Pension Fund's asset managers became top advisors in the UK because we rid them of the exposure to, you know, to U.S. real estate in 89 at the absolute peak. But, you know, there were different examples, different, you know, events where after announcing a sale and closing and we needed the team, you know, to stick around to close things up, but people have lives and they need jobs and they, you know, they said that they were leaving. And, you know, you're young and you panic a little bit. And he was a steadying force to say, folks will do what they have to do and you can't stop them. And, oh, by the way, everybody's replaceable, quite frankly, no matter who it is. And it was at that moment then you realize that, okay, somebody's done this before, somebody's seen this before, and it gives you the confidence to be comfortable with the situation, that anything thrown at you that you will fix. I would also say that probably the most, and I have been quoted so many times in saying this, I will never forget that in one of our many late afternoon conversations when I would ask him, so what do I need to do here? And he said, there's really one thing, here's your job. It's your job to teach everyone around you to be so good that they become better than you. He said, and the leverage effect of treating people that way and the returns from believing in this, that it is your responsibility to make people better, that pays back for the individual far more than the traditional behaviors that you may see in the business world where people are a little more out for themselves or they may be scared to impart wisdom. And I can never pay him back. Because for the rest of my career, and you know, it's over three decades now, that when you do right by people, when you put their interests first, I think it's the best moral compensation that you can ever receive. But it also happens to be some of the best returns on investment because people will follow you up that hill.
Yeah, and you've shown true, you're right, all the way through the three decades, and I think the company and what you're doing now, you're taking that to a whole other level as well. I understand, sadly, Jim passed in 2013, and he sounds like it was someone that you were involved with in some capacity through your entire career. Were there other people like Jim that were part of your life and have been part of your life in a similar type role?
You know, it's so funny. I actually received a request to answer this question yesterday. And, you know, it takes that moment because you focus in on the person that has the greatest impact in your life from a business perspective. But I really have to tell you, there have now been, one is easy, and she was there from the start, and the other are, you know, obviously the people who are part of Avis Young right now. But I really do have to start with, you know, I was married at 23, and you're in New York, and you know, you have a new wife, and you're in public accounting, and you have to make a decision because you're going to leave something that you just joined to be part of something that's a bit of an unknown, a real estate investment trust. All the way through starting my own company after I was able to sell off all of the British Coal funds. That took through, you know, the last asset, which was the Watergate complex. It was complicated and took until 1993. To then start my own company, to then realize that as well as it was going, that really wasn't me. I'm more of a big company person, to sell to Jones Lang Witten, to then be part of the deal team to create Jones Lang LaSalle, coming from the Jones Lang Witten side, to then, you know, in 2005, deciding to, you know, to leave, even though I was a very senior exec, you know, at Jones Lang, being the first person who has ever left the senior management ranks at JLL to run another competitor, but to take over Grubb & Ellis, you know, to fix that company, to raise $100 million, put it back on the New York Stock Exchange, bring in 400 new people. The stock went from, you know, from 4 to 14. And, you know, and that's before Avis & Young. And the one constant and the one relationship that lasted 30 years, and our anniversary was just last month, our 30th anniversary, was my wife, who really has been the rock and the strength, because not everyone would put up with moving from, you know, one or two companies to grow these companies, to have children but be on the road, be in foreign countries, travel as much as I have. And you really have to have quite a relationship. And that partnership, and I look at her as being a rock, and in some ways being that advocate, that mentor, in terms of, it's okay, you have a passion for this, as long as you make sure that you're home for all major events, for, you know, the kids, myself as well, that, you know, that you should pursue this. And I'm not sure everyone has the opportunity to have a rock-solid partner in your career path, your life path, to allow this to happen. So I think she's, quite frankly, even more valuable than, you know, than any mentor. But, you know, when people ask the question specifically about business mentors, you know, it's definitely Jim. You know, and finally, say one last thing. But finally, when you do engage in enterprise building in a partnership structure, the ability to work with the extraordinary partners at AY, we started with 53, we're up to 400, and I would be completely contradicting my belief systems and what I'm able, you know, to talk about on panels and articles if I didn't say that you learn something every day from your partners, and that's just another part of it.
No, it makes... It makes complete sense. I believe, too, talking about your wife, Allison, you actually met when you were, I think you were 18, working in the same grocery store, which is just amazing, and it is a great, another great story. You have a whole list of great stories. What's interesting, actually, is if you took any one of the things, in my opinion, any one of the things that you have done, for a lot of us, that would be our defining moment in our careers, and you seem to keep doing one after another after another, and they're not equal. You keep, in my opinion, the bar gets raised every time. What you did at Grubb was amazing, right? I remember talking to you then, and even more amazing, when I saw you go to Avis & Young, I'm like, okay, here, we'll watch it go again, right? And, it's unbelievable, and I know you're just getting started, which is even the more interesting part. So let's take that further, and I'll shift gears a little bit more on the business side about kind of the broader market from an enterprise standpoint. You look at Avis & Young within the market, and not talking about competitive or where you stand, but just sort of how you navigating this landscape and this company, and then, you know, if you go out 5 or 10 years, where do you see this?
Well, it shouldn't surprise anybody that when you have had a chance to write strategies, right? You know, as I mentioned, we wrote a strategy to tell a pension fund across the ocean, you know, to sell its assets and put yourself out of business, right? That's the right thing to do. To then know whether you belong owning a little company or being part of something big. And writing a strategy there, all the way through to, you know, my JLL days when I had a chance, you know, to write and lead some of the strategies post-merger. You build what you believe in. And it goes back to the experiences that one had, that I had with the previous companies. And I'm dead serious about this. You have to connect the dots. You start out young. You have to fight harder. You're the youngest of four. You sell a company. You see what went right, and you see what went wrong. And very honestly, you know, the merger, being at the table on March 11th, 1999, the merger of Johnson & Wharton, my side, with LaSalle Partners' side, to create JLL, this was a global company, and you knew, because I'd spent time, you know, in other countries with JLW, that something was missing in the culture of understanding that a merger of equals, that no one wins. You actually want to build a company that has its own, you know, history and its, you know, its own value system. And it was many of those, both positives and negatives, that then allowed one to take on Grubb. And that was a crazy 2.5 years to then take you to, you know, to Avis & Young, where you saw this Canadian company with incredible potential. It was probably sixth or seventh in market share. Extraordinary, well-trained people, but by being owned in four separate ownerships, province by province, that they weren't quite able to achieve, you know, the heights that, you know, that that they could. And, you know, when I started talking to them, they mentioned that they had been trying to merge for, you know, for 9 years, and very, very difficult since they were friends. They really all, many of the leaders worked at the same company, Knowlton Realty, and they just couldn't bring themselves to deal with the last few topics, usually around economics. And so it really took an outsider. But what we were able to do here was really the following. That the world needed a global full-service firm that actually was really global. And as you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, the United States of America. But at the time, most of the companies were headquartered just in the U.S. And some of those behaviors, some of the structures were public company structures. Now they're all public companies. We're the only ones by ourselves, and folks, you know, are quick to mention at that point, you know, Cushman & Wakefield is still private. Well, it is and it is, and it has public debt, so they report, and therefore the structure. Oh, it's always about structure. It's always about culture. And that, well, what we were able to do, what sat in front of one was, okay, any new enterprise would love a space that it could differentiate. So having a privately held, principal-led, global full-service company was something that felt right to realign the long-term view to client solutions. There were wonderful people at every other company. So this is by no means a knock against anyone else. They are fine professionals working for fine companies. The difference here was understanding and innovating through structure. That if we made the senior talent owners and aligned them with clients operationally, financially, and reputationally through a principal-led, principal-owned structure that is accountable to their clients, who can take a 10-year view and not have to worry about 90-day incremental reporting, that something very special could happen. And along with that, you've seen us do a few things. One, the company was headquartered in Canada, not just because the company that was the beginning of the platform was in Canada, but we were going to hold a World Series and actually invite the world. And so having it headquartered outside the U.S. was extremely important to us, making sure that countries and cultures feel comfortable that we're going to take a broad view, also understanding that country by country, we operate differently. Subcultures are different. And by the way, the public companies, the largest of the full-service public companies, they know this, but the structures are less capable of actually delivering.
Well, going back to the short-term view, there was a great article in the Harvard Business Review, I think, or somewhere I read a while back. And when you go back three or four decades, you talk about the obligations of a public company and the board and the officers. Actually, the term they would use then, it was about the stakeholders, which wasn't just the shareholders, right? It included the employees and the partners they worked with and the suppliers and tenants or customers and everyone else. It's really been over the last two, maybe three decades where it went from stakeholders to shareholders, which then took us from this long view to this short view of the world, right, which is what you're talking about. So it's interesting.
Well, you know, if you think about this, and we have an opportunity because of the structure, obviously, to talk about this, but, you know, if you think about a stock that you may own, and Scott, I know that you know a lot of people, but if you look at, you know, Apple, I doubt that Tim Cook has invited you into his boardroom and discussed strategies of what he wants to build. If you own Apple shares, your only relationship with Apple is you want to fire up your computer or look at your handheld and hope that Apple moves up a dollar or two or three a day. So why would that be any different than the shareholders of the public companies who we compete against? Their objectives are rising EPS and rising share prices, not a delivery of best practices. And so we believe by taking that longer-term view, that private structure, being led by its principles, pushing equity out to all employees in the company, because our equity is open to every employee in the company, we have taken what was an 11-office, Canadian-headquartered, 293-person, 53 partners, $40 million of revenue, and a couple million dollars of profit, and we are now up to 6 countries, 82 offices, 2,600 employees, over $600 million of revenue, and over $50 million of EBITDA. And it comes from the structure. The structure has allowed us, what I'm most proud about is the structure married with culture. We'll be able to continue this. So you ask the question, there's no reason why in the next few years we're not going to hit $1 billion in revenue and then $1.5 billion in revenue, because human resources in this industry want to be recognized, they want to benefit from the growth, they want their voices heard, they want to have a vote, they want to have the input, they want to put their imprint on something and look at it and say, I was part of that, while we deliver industry-leading service to our clients and customers, because we can, because we're involved. And so when you look at this, the structure and the culture of partnership and of innovation, this has really allowed us to grow, and very honestly, the runway is very, very long in front of us.
Yeah, and I can agree more that the structure, both balance sheet level and structure related to what you've done with your employees, certainly is going to position you for that in a number of different ways. Let's go a little bit further, deeper, I think, on, you talk about culture, and you've talked about it a couple of different ways today with me, and then, you know, prior and stuff I had read. But talk about the values. Like, let's say I'm trying to find a way to work with your company and want to be a, you know, valuable member and have you guys hire me, hypothetically, of course. What values do you look for people? Like when you're looking, whether whatever level, entry level, someone out of college or someone that's been in the space for two decades, you're obviously looking for a very specific profile or certain components or characteristics of those individuals. What are those?
So I'm going to start with the one negative and then I'll answer your question. Imprinted everywhere in our strategy documents, our goals and objectives every year, articles, on and on and on, we have something called the NAR. And the NAR is the no asshole rule. And every person existing or someone who would like to apply to work at Avis & Young, or if there's a professional that wants to move over from a competitor to Avis & Young, they are viewed against the NAR. And I cannot tell you how many, I mean, very successful in revenue, very successful our professionals have asked about us, have asked to meet with us, that we either wouldn't take the meeting or after taking the meeting, make it very clear that you're interested in succeeding on an individual basis. You're interested in succeeding individually that might actually hurt one's clients or your partners. And you cannot be part of this. There was one conversation with someone that I served on a board with who is a leader in a production in one of the major cities in this country. And he said, listen, Mark, I'd really like to sit down. I said, you know what? I love serving on the board with you, but you will never be invited in here. Mark, do you know how much money I make? Like, I don't care if you made that times two. You're an asshole. And you violate the NAR. We are the only company that we know. Like, we cannot come up with another example.
Yeah.
We are the only company who has terminated not one, but two number one producers. And we're only 9 years old. Because the way to becoming a top producer was hurting other people. And we said, this matters. And the most amazing part about this, with the first termination, five clients called the next day and asked us, what took you so long? The other amazing act was, it was a shot heard around the world in the company, and our people said, I guess we really are going to care about culture.
You know what, you've given me an acronym I wish I had, because obviously I work for a tiny firm and I'm in a different space in the scheme of things, but it was in a stuffy but very important deal we were chasing, and we were with the executive team, and I tend to swear a lot, and I was doing really good, and at the end of the meeting, they said, what makes you guys different? And without hesitation, out of my mouth, said, we don't have any assholes. And then I felt awful after the meeting, and I was swearing, and we're trying to abide by the same thing, but you're the first person I've heard say that, and I like the acronym of the NAR, so it's funny. It's true, though.
Well, and you know what? Our private equity group, when they first saw it, they said, well, you can't write that. Well, no, of course we can. This is one of those meaningful measurements we have, because it doesn't matter how much money you make.
Yeah.
It matters how you behave. And that's why we're so successful, because our partners in this company, they talk to each other. They collaborate with each other. And when a team approaches a client's needs, or even before the needs of the client, approaching the clients from a business development point of view, when you do it as a team that all resources are then available to a client, that team approach really can't lose.
Yeah. We're going to run out of time here pretty quick, and I don't want to hold you longer than we're supposed to. I've got a couple more questions. But one is, given your career and given what you know today, if you were to give yourself advice, so when you were 21, graduating from Queens College and coming out and starting to work, what advice would you have given yourself then?
I would say that this advice, and I can't tell you how many things that I would say to a 21-year-old anyone, because I do it all the time. But very recently, over the last year or two, we have made incredible strides in changing the lives of our people through wellness. And the stories are amazing. We have people who have lost 93 pounds, 80, went from not being active to participating in walks, half marathons, marathons, Ironman. We have people who understand that wellness is the foundation of your ability to be a good person and a very successful performer. And I don't think young people know this. I know I didn't. And there was a period of time that I let myself, gain 60 pounds and stop playing hockey and really, quite frankly, stop being active. It was about the businesses and traveling. And it's a much longer story, but on March 18th of 2014, said enough's enough and went from being a obese person to losing 60 pounds, to double my sleep, to ultimately run in a half marathon, do a triathlon, and it's invaluable. You think it's about learning a trade, which people can do. You think about culture, I think you either you have it or you don't. But right now, wellness, and particularly mental wellness, which I put under the banner of whole wellness or whole health right now, our young people need to concentrate on this because this is a very stressful world, whether it's the politics of the day, whether it's what you think people want of you, what your parents might have asked of you, the competition, the amount of information that's available every second of every day through social media. We are watching our young people just get, run over. And the level of anxiety and depression that is taking over not just our youth, quite frankly, everyone right now in business or not. And so my advice is, obviously listen more than you talk and be really, really good to people. But it's critical in 2017, as we're about to head into 2018, that you take care of yourself in both your physical and your mental wellness, because it's impossible to do great things without it.
True. Well, Mark, I can't thank you enough for your time today and your insights and learning more about your what I'd call amazing career, and I really appreciate the time. Want to thank you again. I hope our paths cross again at some point in the future, and I want to thank GPG Advisors for sponsoring it. So thanks again, Mark.
I appreciate it, Scott. Thank you.